headlines this hour, Iran's president warns the U.S. against undermining regional security, saying Tehran will have a, quote, harsh response to any mistake by Washington or its allies. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas condemns the U.S. president's pro-Israel rhetoric upon arrival in Tel Aviv. Also ahead, the European Commission increases inflation forecasts for both Europe and the Eurozone as the war in Ukraine continues to take a heavy toll on the continent's economy. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Iran's president warns the U.S. and its allies that any mistake by them in West Asia will meet the Iranian nation's harsh response. Ebrahim Raisi said the nation will not tolerate any crisis or insecurity in the region. He said that Iran's defense capabilities have brought security to the region. The president also said interference by foreigners, the U.S. in particular, will only jeopardize regional security. Raisi warned Israel that normalization with certain Arab states in the region will never guarantee the regime's security. The Iranian president also censured some regional states for playing into the hands of Western countries in importing instability and terrorism to West Asia. The Palestinian Resistance Front says U.S. President Joe Biden's remarks upon arrival in Tel Aviv emphasized that his support for the Israeli regime. According to Hamas spokesman Hazem Qassem, Biden's statements are in line with the criminal intentions of those who seek to form coalitions with Israel. Right after his plane touched down in the occupied territories, Biden called himself a Zionist. He also doubled down on Washington's military support for Israel and the strong bonds between Americans and Israelis. This is the first leg of Biden's three-day visit, which will also take him to Saudi Arabia. His administration is facing criticism for failing to hold Tel Aviv and Riyadh accountable for their killings of journalists Shireen Abu Akleh and Jamal Khashoggi.
A great Zionist and one of the closest friends of the Israeli regime ever. A true friend and a staunch supporter of Tel Aviv and the Jewish people. This is how Israeli leaders have described you as President Joe Biden, who is on a three-day visit to the region. Biden landed at Ben-Gurion Airport on Wednesday afternoon for his first trip to Israel as president. Biden described his arrival as a homecoming, as he was welcomed by Israel's leaders on the tarmac. While he will be spending some 48 hours with Israeli leaders, he will pay an hour-long visit to Bethlehem and meet with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. Palestinian officials say they have not pinned their hopes on Biden's visit, which they see just as another step towards supporting the occupying regime of Israel.
We have no expectations whatsoever from this visit. The picture is very clear. Mr. Biden is only coming here to support Israel, to try to promote strategic military and intelligence alliance between some Arab countries and Israel and the United States.
All indications show that Mr. Biden and his administration have no interest whatsoever in really supporting the Palestinian people or in exercising any form of pressure on Israel to stop settlement activities and its violations of human rights.
Palestinian people have no hope that Biden's visit will bear any fruit. Like his predecessors, they say, Biden's policies represent the U.S.'s long-standing allegiance to Israel at the expense of Palestinian freedom and dignity. Some Palestinians remain skeptical that such a trip will have any tangible impact on their lives.
There haven't been any changes for decades, and the policy is the same. Israel is a U.S. ally.
He's not the first American president to visit the occupied territories. We saw nothing after every visit. They all agree on the same issues. What's being suggested by the Americans is only economic solutions, but not political ones. There is no talk about a Palestinian state or restoring the Palestinian rights.
The Palestinians, meanwhile, are still hoping that the American leader would fulfill long-overdue promises on the Palestinian issue, rather than offering them more economic incentives. Experts say the last leg of Biden's West Asia tour will be its most significant one. The U.S. president is to fly to Saudi Arabia, obviously as part of more steps toward normalization of ties between the Israeli regime and the Arab world at the expense of Palestinians' rights. Mona Qandil, Occupy Ramallah.
Let's talk about this a little bit more with Mohammer Abusada. He's a professor of political science at Al-Azhar University. Welcome. We just heard a report where obviously there is no signs of any hope by anyone that was talked about in that report, including whether it's an analyst or just everyday Palestinians. And the U.S. president is here when his first, it seems, thoughts were to double down in reality the military support for Israel. In that regard, what message do you think he's sending?
Well, good evening, first of all. Let me say that the visit by U.S. President Joe Biden to the region, we all know that this visit came after reluctance of the U.S. president to come to the region. The main purpose of this visit is to basically push Saudi Arabia and other Gulf countries to increase its oil and gas produced to the international market as a result of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, which resulted in the in higher prices in gas and oil. So we all know that the visit is very much, as President Biden said today, that his visit to the region and to Saudi Arabia is to defend U.S. National interest. Now, his visit also to Israel is also to defend his own electoral interest or his own electoral agenda. We all know that the U.S. is going into mid-elections in November of this year, 2022, and the Democratic Party and President Biden are not doing in those in public opinion polls in the U.S., and by visiting Israel and signing the so-called Jerusalem Joint Declaration with Israel, in which he committed U.S. Support for Israeli security, we all know that the president is trying to very much buy the votes of the Jewish voters in the U.S. and also the financial assistance and support by the Jewish lobby in the U.S. Unfortunately, in the midst of all of that, we only hear very little about the Palestinian case, the Palestinian issue. It seems to me that the Palestinian issue is not on the agenda of President Biden. Even in the joint declaration between the U.S. and Israel, the declaration did not say Israel and the U.S. It said only Biden's commitment to the two-state solution, in which means that Israel doesn't accept even the two-state solution formula for the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. The only thing that came in the joint declaration about the Palestinians, it also spoke about economic support for the Palestinians. It spoke about dealing with the daily affairs of the Palestinians in West Bank and Gaza. It didn't really say anything about the political rights of the Palestinians. It didn't say anything about halting Israeli settlement expansion and creeping annexations in the West Bank and East Jerusalem.
Well, why do you think he has not placed importance on the Palestinian issue? I mean, why is that? Because we know what has happened in the Palestinian territories, in the occupied Palestinian territories, as usual, settlements, detainments, rights violations of Palestinians, including the assassination, by the way, of journalist Abu Akleh, which I don't think any statements have come through yet. But overall, why is the Palestinian issue not a priority for the U.S. president?
That is definitely a very good question. To be honest with you, it's a shame that nothing of what you just said was mentioned by U.S. President Joe Biden during his press conference with Israeli Prime Minister Yair Lapid, or even in the joint declaration between the two countries, the U.S. and Israel. Say that the reason for that is that it seems to me that the Palestinian national rights, the Palestinian political rights, are not in the agenda of President Biden's visit to the region. That's first of all, and second, it seems to me that what we are witnessing in Israel, even though that we have a prime minister who is a caretaking prime minister in Israel, Yair Lapid, who comes from the so-called center left in Israel. But the current coalition government in Israel is not interested in the two-state solution, is not interested in any political settlement with the Palestinians. And it seems to me that President Biden refrained from even saying anything about the killing of Shireen Abu Akleh or anything about Palestinian rights. He did not want to anger his counterparts in Israel. And what is even alarming, and it's even more disturbing to the Palestinians, is that the joint declaration between the U.S. and Israel spoke about their commitment, the commitment of both countries to deny even the Palestinians activity at the ICC, the International Court of Justice, or even to deny the Palestinian a quest for BDS, which is boycott, divestment, and sanction. The U.S. and Israel are trying to deprive the Palestinians of even the non-violent activities to put an end to the Israeli occupation and restore Palestinian national rights. Unfortunately, we are talking about a partnership between the U.S. and the Israeli occupation, in which the U.S. has clearly, crystal clear, sided with the Israeli occupation. And let me just add one more point, which was mentioned by the Israeli human rights organization, B'Tselem. Peace Now. They said today that as President Biden is visiting Israel and the region, the Israeli government is about to discuss the establishment of two new Israeli settlements in East Jerusalem, which will definitely kill even the possibility of a two-state solution in the West Bank and Gaza Strip.
Thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. That's Mukhabir Abu Sada, professor of political science.
Thank you.
At Al-Azhar University. Many thanks. Moving on, Tehran has dismissed a Swedish court ruling in the case of Iranian national Hamid Nouri, who was on trial for allegations leveled against him by the notorious anti-Iran terrorist group, the MKO. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani condemned the ruling as politically motivated. He said the decision is, quote, distorted and lacks legal basis. Earlier, the Swedish court handed the Iranian citizen a life sentence. Hamid Nouri was arrested in 2019 over allegations of human rights violations against MKO members back in the 1980s. Iran says these allegations are, quote, baseless, and his trial is a political pageantry. Last month, in a short phone call with his family, Nouri said that he was tortured while in prison and denied medical attention, despite his deteriorating physical condition. Editor of Veterans Today, Kevin Barrett, says it is shameful and hypocritical of the West to sponsor and arm the MKO terrorist group, which is responsible for the death of over 17,000 Iranians.
It's really curious, because we're living in an era in which so-called terrorism has been systematically demonized, and the United States has proclaimed that it's supposedly leading a global war on terror that will never end, inaugurated, of course, by the false flag events of September 11th, 2001. It's really strange, because this, if any group on earth deserves to be targeted and disbanded forcibly, it's this group. They're completely out of control, and it's shameful that the West has been sponsoring these people and arming them and helping them organize and giving them sanctuary in a number of countries so that they can plan these acts of violence. And they're not even hiding the fact that they are violent, that they're not committed to any kind of open society values whatsoever. So once again, the hypocritical West, which pretends to be in favor of liberal values and free press and so on and so forth, is actually supporting this group that murders 17,000 people in Iran and attacks journalists and basically is running around like another Jim Jones, Jonestown kind of group, except instead of having to run off to Guyana, they're being put up in the best kinds of places across Europe. So it's completely shameful, and it's bizarre, and it would be funny if people weren't suffering so badly from it.
The U.S. government's latest data shows inflation in the country reached a new 40-year high in June. According to the Labor Department, consumer price index was at 9.1% last month. That's higher than the U.S. officials had expected and is the fastest increase in four decades. Energy prices also posted their biggest annual rise in more than 40 years. Many Americans are blaming the U.S. monetary policies and the current administration's mismanagement for the high inflation.
No, I don't think the government's done a good job, because all last year this began, and they did nothing because they thought it was temporary. And you know, during the pandemic, everybody got passed out money, including stores and all of that. And so it's like too much money floating around. They were very late to the game.
Well, I think the Federal Reserve said it was temporary, so I think maybe we could blame the Fed more than we can blame President Biden. They kept saying it was temporary for quite a while, and they finally had to change their tune.
Following the release of the data, President Joe Biden acknowledged that the inflation rate is unacceptably high. Still, he argued the figure is out of date and does not reflect a clear drop in energy prices since mid-June. The central bank last month implemented the biggest interest rate hike in nearly 30 years to rein in the inflation. But so far, that has not been effective. The European Commission has increased inflation forecasts for both Europe and the Eurozone as the Russia-Ukraine war continues to take a heavy toll on the continent's economy. The Commission says that inflation will hit 7.6% in the Eurozone this year. That is up from its projection of 6.1% back in May. The 2023 inflation has also been revised up by 1.3% for Europe as a whole. The inflation forecast has been revised up 8.3% for this year. The figure is 1.5% higher than the body's forecast in May. The continent's inflation forecast for next year has also been hiked to 4.6%. The war in Ukraine, coupled with the West's anti-Russia sanctions, have driven up fuel costs. The conflict has also triggered record-high price rises. Taxi drivers in the Italian capital, Rome, protest for a second day against the government plan to open the market to competition. The demonstrators gathered outside of Prime Minister Mario Draghi's office. They have been protesting for weeks against the new deregulation bill. The drivers fear that the bill will hurt their competitive power by authorizing online services such as Uber. The measure will be discussed in Parliament on Thursday. Draghi is pushing forward with reforms to open up Italy's economy. The reforms are needed to receive billions of euros in EU pandemic recovery funds. And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
Hidden Files. When I was a 12-year-old black American junior high school student in a predominantly white school, I was chosen for an important task due to my reading skills and high diction. Well, the task was to read a eulogy to honor a very important white man who had just died. I, of course, had no idea who this man really was and the suffering he had caused for many. It was only later that I came to know the true John Edgar Hoover, the former head of the FBI and the mind behind COINTELPRO. Hello, and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Well, the man known as J. Edgar Hoover had been the first director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and he'd headed the organization for almost 50 years. He was instrumental in carrying out a deadly program by the FBI called COINTELPRO, which stood for Counterintelligence Program, and existed from the 1950s until the 1970s. Now, this clandestine program was carried out against American activists and organizations.
COINTELPRO was an FBI operation established in the 50s by J. Edgar Hoover to target African Americans who were fighting for justice and equality. He targeted Dr. King, he targeted Malcolm X, and over 80% of the targets of COINTELPRO were members of the Black Panther Party.
And this is what they did during the next 14 years, from federal agents all the way down to local police. They would spy on civil rights leaders and others, which was, of course, illegal. Then they carried out assassinations, both physical and character assassinations, to stifle movements such as the Black Panther Party. Now, in order to justify these assassinations, the federal agents would actually fabricate evidence, set up crime scenes by staging false flag attacks, incite riots, and engage in many other criminal and inhumane activities. Now, the groups targeted by the FBI were quite diverse, from anti-war activists to black nationalists, but none, absolutely none, was targeted quite in the same way as the Black Panthers.
J. Edgar Hoover was FBI director for almost 50 years. It is said he had enough information on just about anyone to blackmail them, even presidents of the country. His number one enemy was the Black Panther Party, as he sought to prevent unity in the black community. As FBI director, Hoover oversaw COINTELPRO and ordered agents to destroy, disrupt, and neutralize the Panthers. In 1969, U.S. domestic intelligence budget was $7.4 billion. There were 295 operations by the FBI against black groups. 233 of these operations were directed at the Panthers. 28 members of the Panthers were murdered by the FBI that year.
One of the main individuals who was targeted by COINTELPRO was Fred Hampton. Now, Fred was a charismatic young law student of the Chicago branch of the Black Panthers. He was a dedicated revolutionary and orator.
We work with anybody and form coalition with anybody that has revolution on their mind. We're not a racist organization because we understand that racism is an excuse used for capitalism. And we know that racism is just, it's a byproduct of capitalism. Everything would be all right if everything was put back in the hands of the people. And we're going to have to put it back in the hands of the people. all powers of people. That's saying that no matter what color you are, there's only two classes. And that's saying there's a class over here and there's a class over there. And the reason that this class over here has never did anything to get this class off its back, because this is lower, this is upper. This is the oppressed, this is the oppressor. This is the exploited, this is the exploiter. And these people in this class have divided themselves. They say, I'm black and I hate white people. I'm white and I hate black people. I'm Latin American and I hate hillbillies. I'm hillbilly, I hate Indians. So we fight amongst each other.
Well, I'd like to welcome to Hidden Files, Johanna Fernandez.
Johanna Fernandez is Associate Professor of History at Baruch College of the City University of New York and author of The Young Lords, A Radical History. Professor Fernandez is the writer and executive producer of the film Justice on Trial, The Case of Mamia Abu-Jamal.
Thanks so much for being with us here on Hidden Files. Now, there's so much evidence that the actions taken under COINTELPRO were illegal. So can you tell us why no one was ever prosecuted for these crimes?
Well, the COINTELPRO program, or COINTELPRO, is an extra-legal organization of repression developed by the American government. It's like the CIA. The CIA is engaged in all manner of homicidal activity around the world, but it's an extra legal organization. So that's a great question. Essentially, we would need a movement exposing, for example, the atrocity we saw with the assassination of Fred Hampton on December 4th, 1969. He was assassinated Latin American dictatorship style in the streets of Chicago, actually in his own bed. And you talked about the relationship between political prisoners, their imprisonment, and sometimes the assassination of black radicals. Well, COINTELPRO sent an agent into the organization, the Black Panther Party, of which Fred Hampton was the leader in Chicago. And that agent identified precisely where Fred Hampton slept and where he would be that night that he was assassinated. And he was assassinated by COINTELPRO that was working with the Chicago Police Department. And the question is, what happened to that agent? That agent was so bereft, he was so destroyed by what he had facilitated that he committed suicide. COINTELPRO stands for the Counterintelligence Program of the FBI, and it was developed by the FBI at the height of the Cold War. And in the 1960s, it was deployed against all of the activists of that period, but in particular, it was deployed against civil rights and Black Power activists. And what we see happening in the 1960s is that there's a moral panic created by politicians that uses the term law and order to criminalize Black protest. And if you look at the history of the 1960s, you'll know that there are various campaigns to free Huey Newton, to free Angela Davis, and to free protesters, activists who were being imprisoned. Even Martin Luther King, if you remember, wrote that famous letter from the Birmingham jail because those who were fighting for their freedom to expand the notion of American democracy were criminalized and imprisoned. So the question is, what is the relationship between political imprisonment, the FBI's COINTELPRO, and mass incarceration? Well, that term, law and order, was the ideological linchpin used by the far right, but also by Democratic politicians, to criminalize radicals, protesters, the urban rebellions. And then in the 1980s and 90s, upon that project launched initially in the 1960s against Black radicals, you see the development and the increase and expansion of this hyper-incarceration of Black people, but also other racialized communities.
Unbelievable. Well, can you tell us about the connection in general between COINTELPRO and political prisoners?
Connection between COINTELPRO and political prisoners, absolutely. COINTELPRO essentially investigated, identified those involved in political action, and targeted their organizations and disrupted them, and made it easy or facilitated the criminalization and imprisonment of activists in the 60s, Black Americans in particular. Very important is the relationship between Black, the imprisonment of Black radicals or the imprison or the repression of the movements for Black freedom and mass incarceration. The fact that there isn't a sustained movement in the United States for Black freedom means that the government can get away with this atrocity. Has 5% of the world's population, but imprisons 25% of the world's prison. We have a situation in which people are framed, not just political prisoners and those who fight for freedom, but people are framed in the streets by the police regularly, and folks are also over. And if you look at the people who are in prison, all of them are poor, working class people. And by one statistic, the average wage of those imprisoned at the time of their imprisonment was $10,000.
Wow.
Is not a salary or that is sustainable in the United States, not even for. So poverty and, of course, racism are at the root of this crisis.
Well, in one of my documentaries, I actually interviewed Fred Hampton's wife, Okuya Najiri, who was lying in bed beside him when the FBI and Chicago police opened fire with about 100 rounds. Imagine this. Well, let's listen to her firsthand account of what took place and also from their son, Fred Hampton Jr.
Jail, I might be anywhere, but when I leave, you can remember I said with the last words on my lips that I am a revolutionary, and you're going to have to keep on saying that.
Fred Hampton was a 21-year-old chairman of the Illinois Black Panthers. The Black Panther Party was striving for the independence of blacks and implemented many social programs.
Can you run me through that, exactly what happened?
Well, on the night of December 3rd...
Someone came into the room, started shaking the chairman. Said, chairman, wake up, the pigs are laughing.
The pigs had knocked on the front door, and... Mark Clark said, who's there? And the response came back, Tommy. Mark Clark said, Tommy who? Tommy Gunn. They kicked the door in and just started shooting.
And I saw bullets coming from, it looked like, the front of the apartment, from the kitchen area.
I could see, like, sparks going in front of the doorway, like shots. I could smell cordite from all the gunshots. And our bed was vibrating like this.
They kept calling out, stop shooting, stop shooting. We have a pregnant woman, a pregnant sister in here. At the time, I was 8.5 to 9 months pregnant. My baby was to be delivered in 2 weeks.
The pregnant sister was my mother-to-be, then Deborah Johnson, now Okuya and Jerry. She's 8.5 months pregnant with me at the time.
Anybody that's been under gunshot know that 5 minutes is 5 hours. You think it's forever. Mm-hmm. And I found out later that this whole assassination took a total of maybe 15 minutes.
heard a pig say, he's barely alive, he'll barely make it. They started shooting again. I heard a sister scream. They stopped shooting. Pig said, he's good and dead now. The pigs were running around laughing. They were really happy, you know, talking about Chairman Fred is dead. I never saw Chairman Fred again.
And I remember saying to myself in my head, you better not stumble, you better not fall, because they will shoot you and say that you're trying to get a gun. So I'm trying to walk, I'm very pregnant, and we're coming out, and there were two lines of pigs I had to walk through. One of them grabbed my robe open, and they started laughing, and they said, what you know, we got a broad here. They grabbed me by the hair and slung me into the kitchen area.
As soon as Sergeant Daniel Groth and Officers James Davis, who are leading our men, announced their office, occupants of the apartment attacked them with shotgun fire. The officers immediately took cover. The occupants continued firing at our policemen from several rooms within the apartment. Thereafter, three times, Sergeant Groth ordered all his men to cease firing and told the occupants to come out with their hands up. Each time, one of the occupants replied, shoot it out, and continued firing at the police officers.
People came through the apartment because they didn't believe the reenactment that then State's Attorney Edward Hanrahan was doing, where he talked about how the police were met, his brave police officers were met with a barrage of gunfire from the vicious Black Panthers. And people lined up all around the block to come through and see. And through the state's own sticks, they put these sticks in the holes. Through the trajectories of the bullets, they could see 90% of the shots were aimed at the head where Chairman Fred.
Well, let's cross back over to Johanna and listen to more of her comments on all of this. Well, Johanna, what happened actually to social activism for change in the U.S.?
Well, movements are not forever, and there's always an ebb and flow. And part of what we've seen is a tremendous uprising, among the largest uprisings in American history, following the George Floyd murder,
right,
by police. And of course, this happened at a very specific moment when there was a lockdown in this country because of the pandemic, and when many people witnessed the inability of the American government to respond to something like a pandemic. So there was a sense of powerlessness. And then we have this horrific atrocity. And there was an uprising of epic proportion. However, movements are different than uprisings and mass demonstrations. Movements are accompanied by the emergence of organizations and sustained organizing and struggle in the streets that essentially create a strategy, that have some kind of theory of how change can happen that is then deployed. And that we haven't seen, in part because part of what COINTELPRO did was to eviscerate organizations and their leaders, and disconnected an older generation of activists and organizers with future generations. So COINTELPRO eroded the tradition of organizing and protest in this country. And so what we've seen in the last 40, 50 years in the main has been mass angry protests that have come and gone.
Well, thanks so much for being with us, Johanna Fernandez. Well, being a tip of the iceberg, while looking at the effects of COINTELPRO, some of the best potential leaders were assassinated. Some had to flee in exile, and others are still incarcerated today after spending decades in prison. Well, this is the best way to destroy any movement. You remove the head, and then basically you have a headless body. Correct information and education are key. That is the reason that education was always one of the main goals of the Black Panthers. They wanted to teach the kids their history. Well, unfortunately, as a 12-year-old, I didn't have the opportunity to be taught my own history. I didn't know the man, J. Edgar Hoover, whose obituary I was reading had been one of the most ruthless enemies of civil rights and other minority movements in the United States. Well, the effects of COINTELPRO is still very much alive. And next week, we will look at political prisoners in the United States and how COINTELPRO was fundamental in having prisoners incarcerated for 4 and 5 decades. Thank you so much for being with us right here at Hidden Files. And make sure we hear from you on our various social media platforms. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
In the limelight.
Members of Congress will argue former U.S. President Donald Trump's notorious "Be There, Will Be Wild" tweet was the catalyst for violent protests on 6th of January 2021. We have prepared for you an article written by Hugo Lowell. The piece is titled "January 6th Hearing to Focus on Trump's Tweet to Extremist Group." The House January 6th Select Committee is expected to make the case at its 7th hearing that Donald Trump gave the signal to the extremist groups that stormed the Capitol building to target and obstruct the congressional certification of Joe Biden's Electoral College win. According to sources close to the inquiry who spoke on condition of anonymity to discuss the forthcoming hearing, the House panel will zero in on pivotal tweets sent by the former President Donald Trump in the early hours of the morning on 19th of December 2020. Donald Trump said in the tweet, "Big protest in D.C. on 6th of January. Be there, will be wild." The Select Committee will say at the hearing, led by Congressman Jamie Raskin and Stephanie Murphy, that Trump's tweet was the catalyst that triggered the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers militia groups, as well as Stop the Steal activists, to target the certification of Joe Biden's Electoral College win. And the Select Committee will say Donald Trump sent the tweet knowing that for those groups it amounted to a confirmation that they should put into motion their plans for 6th of January and encourage thousands of other supporters to also march on the Capitol for a protest. The House Select Committee will say the tweet was the pivotal moment in the timeline leading up to the Capitol attack, since it was from that point that the Proud Boys and Oath Keepers militias seriously started preparations and Stop the Steal started applying for permits. The Select Committee also currently plans to play video clips from former White House counsel Pat Cipollone recent testimony to House investigators at his hearings. Congressman Jamie Raskin is expected to first touch on the immediate events before the tweet. a contentious White House meeting on 18th of December 2020, where Donald Trump weighed seizing voting machines and appointing conspiracy theorist Sidney Powell as special counsel to investigate so-called election fraud. The Guardian has reported the meeting involved Donald Trump and four informal advisers, including Donald Trump's ex-national security adviser Michael Flynn, former Trump campaign lawyer Sidney Powell, former Overstock CEO Patrick Byrne, and former Trump aide Emily Newman. Once in the Oval Office, they implored Donald Trump to invoke Executive Order 13848, which granted him emergency powers in the event of foreign interference in the election. Though that had not happened, to seize voting machines and install Sidney Powell as special counsel. The former president ultimately demurred on both of the proposals, but the Select Committee will say after the Flynn-Powell-Byrne-Newman plan for him to overturn the election fell apart, he turned his attention to 6th of January as his final chance and sent his tweet. The House panel will show the response to Donald Trump's tweet was direct and immediate, noting that Stop the Steal announced plans for a protest in Washington set to coincide with Joe Biden's certification just hours after the former president sent his missive. According to federal prosecutors prosecuting the case, the Proud Boys militia, whose top members has since been indicted for seditious conspiracy over the Capitol attack, also started to crystallize what their plans were for 6th of January 2021, the following day. Prosecutors have said on 20th of December 2020, the former Proud Boys national chairman Enrique Tarrio created an encrypted group chat called MOSD Leaders Group, described by Enrique Tarrio as a national rally planning committee that included his top lieutenants. According to the wildprotest.com website, the day after Enrique Tarrio started the MOSD Leaders Group, the Monday after Donald Trump's tweet that came on a Saturday, the leaders of Stop the Steal applied for a permit to stage a protest on Lot 8 near the Capitol and around that time. Citing the Proud Boys indictment, the House Select Committee will say, through the rest of December and spurred on by Donald Trump's tweet, the Proud Boy leaders used the MOSD chats to plan a Washington, D.C. trip and tell their members to dress incognito for their operation on 6th of January 2021. The House panel intends to show top members of the Oath Keepers militia group led by Stuart Rhodes, who have also been indicted for seditious conspiracy, made similar plans as they prepared to obstruct the congressional certification of Joe Biden's election win. The House Select Committee will then focus on how the Oath Keepers stockpiled weapons and created an armed quick reaction force ready to deploy to the Capitol, and how the group ended up as the security detail for far-right activist Roger Stone and other Trump allies. One of the witnesses providing public testimony at the hearing is expected to be Jason Van Tattenhove, a former spokesperson for the Oath Keepers, who left the group around 2017, but is slated to discuss their motivations and how they operated. The First Amendment Praetorian, Michael Flynn's paramilitary group, is also expected to get a brief mention at the hearing, as will the various war rooms at the Willard Hotel, where both Roger Stone and Michael Flynn, as well as Donald Trump's attorney Rudy Giuliani, were spotted ahead of 6th of January 2021. The House Select Committee, through Jamie Raskin's portion of the hearing, will run through the effects of Donald Trump's tweet on preparations for January 6th, right up until the morning of the Capitol attack and Donald Trump's speech at the Save America rally on their lips. Congresswoman Murphy is then expected to examine the Ellipse rally itself and Donald Trump's incendiary rhetoric, where he told his supporters that he would march with them to the Capitol, giving the pro-Trump crowd the ultimate incentive to storm Joe Biden's certification. Furthermore, Donald Trump's former top strategist, Steve Bannon, suffered heavy setbacks in his contempt of Congress case on Monday, 11th of July, after a federal judge dismissed his motion to delay his trial, scheduled for next days, and ruled he could not make two of his principal defenses to a jury. The flurry of adverse rulings from District of Columbia District Judge Carl Nichols, a Trump appointee, marked a significant knockback for Steve Bannon, who was charged with criminal contempt after he ignored a subpoena last year from the House January 6 Select Committee. Judge Carl Nichols refused in federal court in Washington, D.C. to delay Steve Bannon's trial date set for next Monday, saying that he saw no reason to push back proceedings after he severely limited the defenses that the former Trump aide's lawyers could present to a jury. The defeats for Steve Bannon stunned his lead lawyer, David Schoen, who asked aghast, "What's the point of going to trial if we don't have any defenses?" Judge Carl Nichols stripped Steve Bannon of two of his main defenses for defying the House Select Committee's subpoena, ruling he could not present evidence to the jury that he had relied on the advice of counsel and could not rely on entrapment by estoppel. The argument that the defendant was advised erroneously by an official that certain conduct was legal. Judge Carl Nichols said the decision came in large part because he was bound by the controlling case law at the Washington, D.C. circuit level, which ruled in Licavoli versus United States, 1961. That advice of counsel was no defense against contempt of Congress charges. Judge Carl Nichols also rejected Steve Bannon's claims that he thought his non-compliance was excused by executive privilege and narrowed the arguments Bannon could present to maintain whether he was aware of the deadlines for testimony and producing documents established by the House Select Committee.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.